Blog Talk Radio.
When life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all your needs. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes. So write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out.
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. And it is a great Wednesday evening right here in the heart of the Bluegrass, Lexington, Kentucky. This is Stephen Zimmer broadcasting to you live for episode number 338. So welcome, welcome, welcome. Chat room is open and we're going to have a great guest coming up. Of course, we got a few preliminaries and all that kind of good stuff. And joining me in the co-host seat tonight is the lovely, the vivacious, and the wonderful Holly Phillippe. And I think, Holly, we've got Holly on right now. Hopefully.
Can you hear me? Hello?
I can hear you. Yes, I can. And hi, Holly.
Good.
There she is.
Hello.
Hello.
I am here.
You are here. And the chat room is open, working. Make sure you refresh your page. If you have any trouble logging in, first person in, Metal Beck Harrison. Of course, Book Beck Adventures, her new blog. Check that out when you get a chance, and we'll have some more. It looks like Diana Bazorik's coming in now. And so, yeah, chat room starting to get some activity there. So that's going to be good because we're going to have, a great show. And we do have some cool news for you. Of course, last week we announced that Imaginarium had its first wave of panelists announced, and then after that, we had our first Imaginator guest, and it was an Imaginator guest that you know, because if you've been listening to the Star Chamber show, we've had an episode with this guest, none other than Dacre Stoker, and I know as I can speak for Holly when I say that we're stoked that he is aboard and is coming next July 14th to 16th to the 10th anniversary, and of course, wrote the official prequel to Dracula, and just an absolutely fascinating individual. Guides tours in Europe of the original sites involved with the Bram Stoker novel, and of course, the great grandnephew of Bram Stoker, I might add. But just an absolutely great international best-selling author, and he's supposedly
really cool guy.
From what I hear, he's got a great display. And it's going to be bringing lots of memorabilia, vintage memorabilia from Bram Stoker that's going to be here. And so, yeah, I know Holly's going to – it's be hard for Holly to contain herself, I think, for the next several months. But,
Yes, it is.
But, yeah, that's going to be great. And, like I said, we're all genre conventions, so we've got some surprises for you coming. From other genres and our spotlighted guests and other Imaginators and our guest of honor and all that's in the works. So we have a lot of announcements coming. We've got a lot of spotlighted guests and panelists to announce. I'll just run a little behind this weekend getting some of those announcements out, but we should have a little some announcements tomorrow on some new guests. So look for that. And looks like Sandy Lender. Hello, Sandy. Let's see Sandy jumping in the chat room as well. And we did have one serious thing to pass along that was a bit heartbreaking. We learned that author Jay Wilburn passed away yesterday. We learned yesterday that he passed away, and it kind of caught us by shock because, I didn't know that, he had been, that sick. But evidently, he passed away yesterday, definitely left too early. He was a great guy. I had many good interactions with him. Always had a sense of humor, very talented writer. One of the cool things about the
previous Imaginarium guest.
He came to the first Imaginarium, and I wanted to add to that if you want to, I invite you to hear him. But one of the cool things about our show is that, of course, we archive all the episodes, and I found that he was our guest along with Logan Masterson, who has also unfortunately has passed away. But both of them were our guests on the show that took place a week before the very first Imaginarium back in 2014. So he and Logan were the guests a week out from the very first Imaginarium. And so, yeah, there's an episode sitting in our archive at episode number 41. Yeah, it's a ways back. You know, as you know, we're up to 338 as of tonight. But it's definitely a way to celebrate him, you know, if you knew him, you know, if you want to get to hear him. And, yeah, definitely invite you to check that out, because, yeah, this was really sad and affected a lot of authors we know as well, so, because you knew him very well.
Yeah.
So that was sad. And so, yeah, condolences to him and
mm-hmm.
his family.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know that Armand Rosamia was very close to Jay, author, and he was with him at bedside when he passed, and I saw that today. And so, yeah, definitely condolences to everybody that was, in Jay's family and close circle there. So, anyway, yeah, just wanted to pass that along because definitely he was been a part of Imaginarium history and been a part of Star Chamber show history. And so, yeah, we wanted to definitely honor him tonight. But yeah, we'll be getting some new guests for you. And this week, probably another wave of panelists and a few more spotlighted guests. And, of course, everything is open as far as vendor tables and registrations. And you can nominate for the Imagine Awards. And we have submissions for the film festival. So you can even get banquet tickets now. So everything's active. So. Yeah, definitely check all that out. And but tonight's show is brought to you by Sandy Lender, the Genre Blender, and also the one, the only Ren Garcia with his famous question. So I think tonight we'll go ahead and start with Ren, and then we'll have Sandy spot next. So check it out, and Holly, whichever one of us is faster to answer the famous question. But here's Ren's spot.
The League of Elder dares to be unusual. It's easy to be swept away in this bold and uninhibited landscape where fantastic heroes become old friends and sinister villains inhabit every dark corner. Dare to explore things best left alone. Each book is your lantern, lighting the path to a world never before seen. So what do you say? Are you weird enough for us?
Yes.
Oh, indeed we are, Mr. Ren Garcia.
We are. And check out his League of Elders series. Extremely good series. He's built quite a franchise with that. Definitely a labor of love from Ren. It's a great literary work, and it's a great cross-genre, sci-fi, fantasy. It's got so many different elements. Cool stuff. Check it out. And then we also got tonight, bringing you tonight's episode, Sandy Lender. So check out some Sandy Lender titles, and check out this spot.
The latest release from author Sandy Lender is book 3 of the Fairy Holiday series titled I Know What Your Vampire Did Last Summer. It's a standalone story in the series, but it's got all the fun, humor, horror, and sweet paranormal romance you'd expect of a Lender Blender vampire satire. Come on down to the Naples Hideaway and Marina for a fun and romancy vacay. But watch out for the Grendwolves and the random femme fatale who thinks she's competing for your vampire's attention. Pick up I Know What Your Vampire Did Last Summer by Sandy Lender today.
Lender, Blender, Vampire Satire. I got it. I got that down, Holly. But I love it.
That's a lot.
Yes. But thank you, Sandy. That is awesome. And definitely appreciate it. I see that award-winning author, filmmaker Amy McCorkle has dropped in the chat room. Of course, we had a great visit with her recently, and I would like to congratulate her. Yeah, because Holly and I had a bit of a thrill. Amy's movie, Letters to Daniel, just dropped on Amazon Prime over the past week. So definitely that was awesome to get to check that out, on the big screen TV. And also, along with that, Amy put the trailer with it, and lo and behold, if you look in the trailer, Holly appears in it, And then I actually appear in it because I played myself in the movie because it does a scene from Imaginarium and awards ceremony. And so Tony Acri and I were both in that scene. And Amy used a shot from there in the trailer. And then also right before that, when the audience is coming in, if you look, you get a great shot of Holly turning around and walking into the screening room. And that was cool. I know Holly was thrilled. That was cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was pretty wild. But, yeah, I'm so happy for Amy. She is there on the Amazon now. Woo-hoo!
Yep. Yep. They're on Amazon. So I'm very excited. And
so now everybody can check it out.
And unlike Rings of Power, her movie is something I actually look forward to seeing on there. Well, I have seen it on there, but I had to get that little joke in, of course. but yes,
Amy said, yeah, my strut. Yeah, you guys, you go watch the trailer or watch the movie. You will see my fabulous strut. I do really good walk in the background scene.
That's great. The Holly strut. That is awesome. And, yeah, that was too much. When we popped up that trailer, I was like, oh, my God, there's Holly. And I thought, yeah, that's great. You know, and I was just relaxing. And then it got near the end of the trailer, and all of a sudden, it's yours truly right there. That's just awesome.
She said it's also on Freevee and Apple TV Plus.
Yeah, Freevee and Apple TV Plus. Freevee is a cool channel, a lot like Tubi. If you are familiar with Tubi, a great channel of movies, but they do have those little commercial spots. That's how they take care of themselves there, but good channel. And then, of course, Apple TV, all you Apple users are familiar, but check that out. Letters to Daniel, directed by Amy McCorkle and Melissa Goodman. And it was cool to see on the Amazon listing, the little directed by Melissa Goodman, directed by Amy McCorkle, those little tags underneath the movie. I love seeing those, to see what else people do. And they had their data in there. That was pretty awesome. So, yeah, you're underway. You're underway. So, yeah, I hope it goes really well. That is fantastic. But, yeah, it was a definite little personal thrill for Holly and myself to see ourselves, that we made the cut on the trailer. So that was pretty awesome. And so, all right. Well, I'll tell you what, Holly, our guest is ready, it looks like. So even though it's about a minute or two early, I say we just get our guest aboard because I think we're going to have a great, great discussion tonight, don't you?
Yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Yeah. And tonight's guest is joining us for the very first time. And tonight's guest is an author and mental health advocate. And his autobiographical book, The Psych Ward Notes, Surviving Anxiety and Depression, chronicles his childhood, the origins of his mental illnesses, history of medications, decades spent in therapy, marriage, careers, and journals written from psychiatric hospitals, and theories on how to handle your own mental illnesses. So joining us tonight for the very first time, we welcome on to the Star Chamber Show live podcast, the one, the only, Peter Vox. Peter, your microphone is on. Welcome.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Can you hear me?
Perfect.
Can hear
perfect.
You great.
Welcome.
Yay, my microphone's working.
Yes, it is.
The microphone is working. We aren't having any major storms here in Lexington tonight to knock out our transformer, which has happened during a show once. No tornadoes.
Yes.
So I knocked on wood, but we're off to a good start.
That's good.
When
that's
you
good.
Have a live podcast, anything can happen.
That's true.
Yeah, live, you have to be ready for just about anything, but I've been looking forward to speaking with you, and I know Holly's got a lot of stuff she wants to talk with you about. Looking over at your book, which I'm definitely going to read. I mean, just looks fantastic and very candid, very open, very, soul-searching, something where you really laid yourself bare in this book and you really shared a lot. And so I'd like for you to talk in your own words about your book and in your words what it's about and what you hope people get out of it, and then we'll move on, and Holly and myself will definitely discuss a lot of stuff about it with you.
Okay. So, well, when I was hospitalized, I decided with the advice of a psychologist to start keeping a journal. And after I was discharged, I decided to have it published into a book. And I was I wrote about everything that had happened to me in my life, the origins of my mental illness, the other patients in the hospital. And I realized that mental illness is on the rise in this country and internationally. And being someone that's 53 years old and having this since I was a child, I'm seeing changes in people, and more people are coming down with anxiety and depression for whatever reason, societal pressures. And I figured I had something to share, given all the experience that I had, and to let people know that they're not the only ones that feel this way. And so basically, I took all those experiences, and I was as honest as possible, and I put it into a book. And I never thought I would write a book, but it turned out I filled up three journals of notes.
Wow.
and observations about myself. And after I got tired of writing about myself, I started looking around the hospitals I was in, and I figured I would write about what's going on around me and the people that I was becoming friends with who were have been hospitalized for years, talk to them about what their illnesses are. I spoke to a lot of people that were schizophrenics who heard voices in their heads, and I never spoke to people like that. I wanted to know, well, what did the voices sound like, and what did they tell you to do? And it became a fascinating experience, and I started learning more about myself and how to handle my own issues and how to continue on with life after I got discharged, and what I'm going to do and how to survive. And that's basically the motivation behind everything
was motivation.
It's a good word. The motivation was to find out about everybody's stories and the inner workings of psychiatric hospitals, and to share it with whoever's interested in reading it.
I do have a question. Do you feel that? I know times have changed, obviously, but we have a lot more. But do you think, not only with the different stresses we have in our world today, because we have, so many evolving things that people are now bringing to light, that, our inability to communicate, we text, we don't do a lot of interpersonal communication, that has broke down, and like millennials, Generation Zs, we know we've got to get back to that. But do you feel that by opening up, people seem to be opening up more and talking about their mental issues and different problems and like medications they're on? And it seems to be more mainstream now than even 10 years ago, say. Do you feel that's a plus?
I feel it's a plus to a certain extent, because there are people that have serious mental health issues. It's congenital. There's a family background. It runs in the family. But then there's the other side that maybe it's a bit of a fad, and people are someone that's going through just having a rough couple of days for the first time in their life, all of a sudden they go to a therapist or a psychiatrist and they say, I'm feeling a bit stressed out from work. And they get diagnosed very quickly and get put on medications very quickly when they don't really need it. And there's a careful balance that has to be kept with overreacting to it. And for people that aren't, you know, fortunately aren't mentally, that don't have mental illness, and then with mm-hmm. people that have had it for years. And, you know, that there's people have to be careful of, especially with the medications that they're volunteering to take.
Right. I totally agree there. Yes. Yes.
But
there's a lot better. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, it's great that the subject matter is now more open than it was, and the stigma is less about it.
Right.
Which is fantastic, because it gives people more understanding of what other people go through. Because if you're experiencing trauma, it changes the physical makeup of your brain, and you have to you have to deal with that and learn how to heal and recover from that. So it's great that there's lots of different avenues for people to investigate, you know, different websites and there's plenty of things on YouTube that people can watch to do research. So it's in that aspect, it's great that there's a lot of different ways that people can find out about what's going on with them.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more in the way of resources and communities and that than there were, you know, a couple decades ago, for instance.
Absolutely.
And being able to find others that you know that could relate to you. But with you, you had some self-motivation, though, in terms of approaching your situation, because as I understand it from speaking with Holly and looking at your information, you checked yourself in to the hospitals, and how did you get to the point where you realized that, you know, it's to that serious of a degree where, you know, you took that very large step, you know, to check into a hospital?
It was, I had a rough few years since 2013, in particular, and on top of dealing with the pre-existing anxiety and depression, things just started spiraling. And I was also not experimenting on my own. I was experimenting with new medications. And unfortunately, those medications led to 3 suicide attempts. So for the first few times, I was admitted 5 times. So the fifth time I was admitted, I had taken a handful of about between a 10 and 15 Ativan, because the emotional pain that I was experiencing was actually, it was a side effect of the Ativan. So I didn't know that was the side effect of Ativan, was suicidal ideation. So I kept taking more and more. And I got to the point where I just didn't care. I took a handful, and I knew that I needed to go to the hospital for an extended period of time. And the mistake I made was obviously taking all those pills, because I could have died. But instead of saying, you know, I need to go and I'll just go and check myself in, I did something overly dramatic. And I woke up at the hospital. I was wearing different clothes when I took the medication, and so obviously somebody changed me into the hospital garb while I was unconscious. And after I took the pills and I laid down, I knew I was going to be staying for a while. So I knew that they were going to have me stay whether I wanted to or not. But at that point, I was willing to try anything to get myself better. So Unfortunately, the way I went into my last time in was not the greatest way, but the other times that I went in, I was feeling suicidal, just feeling out of control, and it was the opposite of what the basis of my anxiety and depression are, which is an actual fear of death and an existential sadness of just being overly aware of mortality. And my behaviors were the opposite. So I said, well, now I'm trying to kill myself and I'm someone that's afraid of death. Something's going on. And
right.
I had gotten to the point where this needs to be taken care of finally. And that's what led to the hospitalizations. I probably should have been hospitalized when I was 14 or 15 years old. When I was 50, I learned that schizophrenia ran in my family. So that was, I don't know if it was intentionally kept from me or by my parents, or if it was just they sort of dropped the ball when I started therapy, but had, and this was 1984, so had I been hospitalized at that point, because I just didn't see a future as a teenager. So and I started therapy at that point, but I feel I should have been hospitalized as a teenager, and maybe things could have been handled a little bit differently. But I managed to finish high school. I managed to go to college. I have a bachelor's in music, and then I got a master's in physical education. So I wound up, you know, having a seemingly normal life. People that know that I wrote a book and have read it, and old friends that I grew up with had no idea that I was going through this. And they were surprised, like, how did you? I had no idea. And I said, well, I'm good at hiding it because I didn't not want to be made fun of. I wasn't afraid of that. I just didn't want to ruin my friendships and having fun with my friends. So I just kept it in. And, I would hold it in all day at school until I would see my therapist. And I would just let everything out at my therapist, who he was a person, a nice guy, but didn't ask deep probing questions like other therapists, future therapists that I had did. So then a couple of times I would catch him falling asleep in the session. And I'm like, is he even listening to me? You know? So I look back on it as a terrible time, but also an interesting time that to learn from at that point.
Wow.
We have a two-part question from the,
sure.
from the
actually,
chat room.
Actually, it's a three-part now. I think you're talking about the support
yeah,
system,
Scott
Sally. Yeah, go ahead and tackle that. Yeah, because that's a good one.
Okay.
Sandy's wondering, what support system did you have around you when you were in those dark places experiencing the suicidal thoughts? Did you have, what was your support system around? And how did you develop a support
after that?
Oh, that's a great question. While I was going through the downward spiral since 2013, I started shutting everybody out. I probably lashed out at every close friend and every relative that I had. So I started cutting everybody off. And either I had bad things to say to people. I aired grievances that I was holding in, grudges that I had for many years. People that I was still on good terms with, I was just not calling. I was just not calling anybody. I was relying on medication, my therapist, and my parents. They were the only ones I was speaking to mostly at the time, which probably wasn't the best thing because they were the ones that sort of enabled the depression and anxiety to foster because it runs in the family. So they weren't abusive people. They were people that lived in fear, neuroses, and they would make that worse when I would speak to them. So it probably wasn't the best choice back then. But after I got discharged, I learned to open up more to my friends, to call people. You know, you got to be proactive these days. Call people when I need to speak. Other than mental health professionals, and then I had case managers, a couple that I was very fond of, and one that was sort of I felt was holding me back and making me go backwards, and I started making more friends online with people who suffer with the same thing, and being particular with who you speak to, because if you're talking to someone that doesn't get it, they're just going to say, oh, you know, just get over it, or you have to get over that, or it's one day at a time.
Or it's all
give you
in
some,
your head, you know.
It's all in your head.
That's the good one. Yeah, it's like, literally it is, you know. Yeah.
It
you
is.
Wanna, you want to just soak them. It's like, yeah, it is, you know.
Yeah.
I just love those comments when people will say that, and I'm like, you know, no. You're right. That's great advice. People that don't get it, don't even waste your breath, because
Exactly. Because unfortunately, you know, they'll never understand until it happens to them. You don't want something bad to happen to somebody. But like I said, there's mechanisms in it. It's a button in your head that's stuck in the on position that it just doesn't turn off. And for some people, you're born that way, and for some people, it's caused by trauma, or it's caused by both. And for me, I feel because schizophrenia ran on my mother's side of the family, and anxiety and depression ran on my father's side of the family, that I was predisposed to this, and it was only a matter of time where it would come out. And unfortunately, it came out very, very early in life. And I'm someone that has a photographic memory. I remember things to great detail. And unfortunately, one of my first memories was being out at cemeteries when I was 2-3 years old. And my first, the first subject matter of my life that I remember being exposed to was death. And unfortunately, you know, on my mother's side, my uncle passed away at a young age, and then a few years later, his son passed away, and then on my father's side, my aunt passed away. Then my uncle got remarried. His new wife had a son that was my age, and he passed away. And it was just my mother's friends passed away. I had a neighbor that passed away.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so it was and then you add my father's neuroses of, oh, you can't eat this, you can't eat that, this causes cancer, that causes cancer. By the time I was 7, I knew every single ingredient in food that caused cancer.
Well, that's
so
good and bad, you know.
Good and bad, but being reminded of it every day at impressionable ages, it starts making you obsess over it. And
you're paranoid.
And then you add the philosophical part of my brain that goes, well, what's the meaning of life? And what was I before I was born? And what happens after you die? And what existed before the what existed before the universe? And after you get to a certain point of your comprehension of things where you can't think any further, it produces just these panic attacks that were just, you experience sheer terror, that you feel like you're not in control of anything. And then you add on being very aware of the world at the time, sort of similar to what's going on now. When I was a teenager, the threat of nuclear war with the Soviet Union, and you know, now what's going on with Russia and Ukraine and Putin with the nuclear weapon threats and everything like that. I feel like I'm 15 again. I'm going, oh my God, you know, I'm going through the same things that I did when I was a teenager, you know, always checking the news to make sure nothing's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But going back, you know now when
you're going overboard, and you can see those patterns now. Mm-hmm. So you can back yourself up. See that it is fortunate that it's not fortunate that it happened, but it's fortunate that it did happen younger in your life, to where you can reflect and you could see, oh, my father did this every single day and caused me to be, you know, obsessive about the cancer thing. And now I know if I check the news obsessively, what's going to happen? I'm going to spiral. And so now you're in more control.
Sure. Yes, you have to know what your the buzzword of the last few years is what triggers you. You know, so what's gonna trigger your imagination to get out of hand, and you avoid those things. You know, it's simple. Yep. You avoid certain subject matters because you know it's going to set you off. And if I listen to the news too much, or you know, even spending a lot of time on social media, even if you're having fun, you're still, like on Twitter, for example, with promoting the book, I would spend hours, right after it was published, I would spend hours and hours, you know, scrolling through and leaving comments and putting up pictures of the book cover and everything. But I'm still reading negative things, people fighting saying nasty things to each other in the political climate. And I was started stressing out. I was having anxiety And I said, why am I having a rough time right now? I accomplished something positive. I just published a book. And so why am I anxious? And then I clicked. I said, oh my God, I'm not getting much sleep because I'm on the internet all night. And I realized, I'm like, even if you're having a good time on it, you're still seeing negative things, even though you're scrolling past it and not participating in it, you're still reading it. And it does sink into your subconscious, and it does affect you. I mean, even if you're on YouTube all night and you're watching, you know, old Bugs Bunny cartoons for 12 hours and you don't get enough sleep and you got to go to work the next day and you're anxious, it's because you've been exposed to too much stimulus, whether it's positive or negative.
Right.
And you didn't give your brain a chance to rest. That will cause stress. So you could have the greatest time watching movies all night, but you know, having that blue light, having that screen light in your face and not resting will still cause some stress and anxiety. Absolutely. And then if you're participating in the negative aspects of social media, then you're really going to have some anxiety and depression from it. Because because even people who feel, you know, they call them keyboard warriors, and they don't care who they argue with, and they love insulting or trolling or whatever they do.
Yeah.
It's still going to cause a problem for them in the long run, I feel.
That's true. So, like I always say, the internet is troll infested territory now. But,
absolutely.
I laugh about it a little bit, but it's true. But I think it also, you know, getting to your, you know, discussion of mental illness and everything, though, we have a hyper a hyper-saturated society, I mean, in terms of news and things like that. And, I mean, it just comes at you from all angles. I mean, all these different platforms and all these different media. I mean, it's like on steroids compared to, you know, the days when you had, you know, basically, you know, three major news channels and, you know, newspapers and, you know, a few other things. I mean, just the sheer volume out there is just very different. And then the fact that it's interactive now, and you're not only engaging with the, you know, the content creators, but you're also getting into fights and engaging with, you know, the people that are, you know, consuming the media. So it's sure. It's like there's so many levels to it, and yeah, it's got to be overload. And I've talked with Holly about that. I mean, I think that the social media age has done a lot. You know, is definitely a big reason why I think you're seeing an escalation in a lot of you know, mental illness. I think it's got a big. It's not the only reason, but I think it's definitely got a part to play.
It's a big part of the recipe. Yeah. It's definitely a big part of the recipe. You know, people love to blame video games and music. And movies. When I was younger, the one good thing that my parents, you know, taught me was this is entertainment. It's not real. And you know, the video games get pretty graphic, and the things I see my sons play, I'm like, how are you, this disgusting, are you watching,
right.
You know, like Mortal Kombat. They love it. And I'm like, you know, this is just entertainment, right? And I started them when they got into it. I was not a big video game person. Being a divorced person, I can't control what my ex-spouse lets them, how much she lets them play video games. And, but you know, I'm guilty of it too, of rewarding them because they get great grades and of rewarding them with games and things like that. But the big thing is explaining to them, this is just entertainment. It's not real. You don't do this in the real world. And if you catch them at the younger ages to say, hey, this is just for fun, you know, or lyrics in music, I'm like, it's just someone expressing their feelings, it's just for fun. If you keep it in that context, I feel it can lessen, you know, their opinions and about certain things and how they react to certain situations in life. So, the social media, my sons don't have any social media accounts because of that reason. Getting into arguing with people, and the good thing is they're not interested in they're not interested in Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and things like that. And also what it's producing, what the social media sites are producing, are lots of people that are so self-absorbed that they don't have the capacity to have feelings for others or really want to interact with others. They stay isolated, which adds to the depression and anxiety, so they don't even realize what they're doing to themselves.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, but if you notice now the whole social climate, children are much more desensitized because of what they do see in social media, on the TV, on their parents' phones, laptops, tablets. You know, they don't even have to have accounts. It's what they're seeing at school, what they're, you know, hearing other folks talk about. They're so much more desensitized than I think what we were like back in the 80s. I feel we were much more sympathetic. Things were more in hiding, not in the open like they are now. I mean, there's good and bad. We have evolved. But, things have been much more desensitized. And with video games and stuff, like, they could sit there. I know my son, they're all adults now. But, I mean, he'd sit there and play the awfulest things. And I'm like, oh, my God, how do you play? You know, oh, my God, no, I would, you know. But, I mean, he's like, oh, I, no, you know, just mow people down. It's nothing. And it's like, wow, you know, we're going back. We're coming from the Atari. We play ping pong.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We played
Galaga.
Yeah. Yay, we were shooting bugs, you know, and the controllers for these games, it's got A, B, C, circle, square, X, two joysticks, one for each thumb, and then you got buttons on this, two or three buttons on the front, and I'm like, I can't even use this. And they go, what's so tough about it? I'm like, listen, I want one button to fire, and I want one joystick to go up, down, left, and right. That's it. That's all I need, you know.
Exactly. I tell my son that. He's like, Mother, it's not that hard. I don't understand why you can't catch it. It's not that hard. And I'm like, it is. I come from a red button and a joystick. That's all
exactly. Exactly. Like the double game of, you know, remember when they combined you could play Miss Pac-Man or Galaga on the same machine.
Right.
You know, you had the choice. So
that was state of the art.
And it was simpler, you know. And I've had my sons cry when they don't get to the next level. And I'm like, you crying over a video game? I'm like getting to the next level is supposed to be harder. And then I pull out, when I was your age, you know, I said, listen, when I was your age, if we lost, we had to pay to play again.
Right.
Had to pay a quarter, you know.
Uh-huh. Right.
Well,
the beginning
many
of my
afternoons
anxiety.
As a kid.
Yeah.
Many afternoons as a kid going through my stack of quarters.
Yeah.
And Stephen knows this. Mario causes me anxiety now. If I go back, we'll go back because we have like a whole bunch of the retro systems. And we'll go back and play like the old Mario Brothers. It makes me so anxious now. I don't remember it making me that anxious then, but now when I play it, I'm like, oh, it just upsets me. I'm like, Steve, I can't. I get upset. And I'm like, this is making me more anxious than anything. You know, I don't even have fun when I get so aggravated with it. I'm like, I don't remember doing that back then, but I do now. I get just anxious.
there's
it's a trigger.
Yeah, there is that part of it where they, like I said, I've had my son cry, one of my sons cry that he didn't get to the next level, and I said, this is supposed to be fun for you, and if it's causing this a total meltdown, then I'm taking it away. And I eventually took away the Xbox. I threw it in the dumpster because we got to a point where that's all they wanted. Being a retired phys ed teacher and playing sports my whole life and someone that's into fitness, their doctor told me, they said, you know, they need to eat better. They need to exercise. And I said, well, all right, we're going to start an exercise regimen. And it was August of 2021 when I threw out the Xbox because they were giving me a hassle every time we had to train. And I'm not training them like Olympic athletes, so I'm easing them into it. And anytime I needed to train them, their attitude would completely change and they would be defiant. And I said, you know what? I'm taking the Xbox away. The doctor says you need to train. And what kind of person would I be, having taught phys ed for almost 22 years. And then I was a personal trainer before that. So I said, what kind of father would I be if I don't show you what I know? And, I threw out the Xbox. They didn't see me destroy it before I threw it in the dumpster, but I had my way with I had my way with it out by the dumpster. I didn't want them to see me breaking it. Cause that wouldn't have been cool, but I destroyed it. Most definitely.
Oh,
they're like, where
Noah,
is it?
He would have actually probably hurt himself. I'm not kidding you. He was that upset. As a teenager. My daughter, Diana, is in the chat room right now, mm-hmm. and tuning in, but she loves video games too, but she says, and she has, you know, some mental health things going on, and mm-hmm. you know, she says Mario just makes her want to rage, but Noah was so attached to his Xbox that, you know, if he would do something, that's what I would take. I would take mm-hmm. his Xbox while he was at school. He would come home and throw a total meltdown and just, you know, rage. And I'm like, obviously, this is not good for you, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then I start eliminating his time in the evenings and 8 o'clock, the bedtime was at 9 at that time. 8 o'clock, we had quiet time. There was no screen, yeah. you know, unless they watch like TV or something. But I'd want them to read, you know, like read mm-hmm. or something. Just cool out from like 8 to 9 so their brains could start relaxing and calm down.
Yep.
They understand it now, obviously. But back then, they, you know, I was the worst person on the planet. But
sure.
yeah, now they get it, you know, that my daughter has kids of her own and everything else. But yeah, you're right. It is an addiction just like anything else. You're replacing one thing with another. If you have an mm-hmm. addictive personality, it don't matter if it's the internet or like you said, movies or whatever. It's not always, people think addiction, they think drugs, alcohol,
mm-hmm.
Sex, you know, stuff like that. But no, it can be anything.
Anything that gives you that dopamine rush, you know, or endorphin,
yep.
you know.
That's it.
Yeah, it's tough. And it's not even... You know, I mean, some of the games are gory and the subject matter is questionable, but it's not even that. It's the amount of time bent on it, you know, and that's what causes the problem. It's getting them away from it. And just doing that can cause anxiety and even depression for some kids, you know. They don't have the game that they want. They feel the pressure to play it all the time, and with some kids, it's the only communication they have with their friends. They play online, and they're talking to their friends
true.
Through headphones. And I would say to my sons, I'm like, "Why don't you invite them over?" You know, I'm like, "I'm like, you could play, but why? How about you guys are all in the same room together? You know, and you see each other and." There's a whole facet of life that you're missing out on, and that's an interpersonal relationship. And when I watch movies with my sons, I make sure that their phones are off. I'm like, turn off your phones. I'm like, we're going to watch a movie. And they would say, well, how come, you know, we can watch a movie, but we can't play the video games? And I said, because when you're playing your video games, there's four of us in one room, and four of us are doing four completely different things, and none of us are talking to each other. If we're watching a movie, we're all concentrating on the one thing. If it's a comedy, we're all laughing together. We're following the story together. We're experiencing it together, and it builds the bond of the relationship between everybody. And going back to being isolated, people are getting used to being isolated, and that's becoming the norm. And unfortunately, the norm
right.
comes with its downfalls. And you have unfortunately, suicide is on the rise, and you have people killing themselves, and with no warning, and they're snapping right away without any telltale signs that they were going to do something like that. So it's a little
right.
frightening in that respect.
And then their friends, you know, after it happens, like, well, I had no idea, you know,
yep.
and come to find out they haven't talked to them in months, you know,
yep.
but it's like, you know, when something bad does happen, you know, Steve was talking about this earlier. When something bad does happen, then, you know, all these people show up out of nowhere and
mm-hmm.
act like they were just, you know, very tight with the person and close, and they probably haven't talked to him in months, maybe years, you know,
yeah.
and they come out of the woodwork. So, and I know we're all bad about that. We get busy. We live fast paced lives. We all are disconnected from one another, but we use, like our family, I believe everybody should get like some kind of group chat going. I don't care if they do it with their text messages. But just get a chat going with people, because if you get a group of people, somebody's eventually going to answer. We have like a little family group going. We talk every single day, you know, even if it's only a one-word thing, just to check in. Just check it in. Say, hey, I'm okay, but I'm really busy today. So if you don't hear from me, don't worry. You
it's
know,
funny.
Like the girls, if they don't hear from me, they say, "Was mom? What is wrong with mother?" And they're calling me. Why haven't you answered on the chat? I'm like, well, I was busy. Yes.
What I
you
find
know?
Funny is nowadays you have to ask somebody if you can call them. You have to make an appointment to make a phone call. Before any of this, you just picked up the phone and called somebody. You know, I had my list of my friends, their phone numbers. I can't remember anyone's phone number now. I couldn't tell you people's phone numbers.
Either.
You know, but I could still tell you all my friends' phone numbers from when they were kids. But now it's like, oh, can I call you later? It's like, well, I might be busy, or people don't want to be bothered with phone calls anymore. And it's on one hand, we have all this great technology to bring us closer, but at the same time, it's dividing people at the same time. It's a strange paradox. You know, while everybody has the ability, while we have this advantage of bringing people together, it seems that there's more fighting going on and more dissension. So it and I think that's like I said, it adds to that recipe of the rise of mental illness and you know, depression, anxiety, and people, you know, hurting themselves, which is the main aspect of the book that I want to get out to people, is that, you know, don't hurt yourself, you know, whatever medications you're taking, just know what the side effects may be. And if you're feeling suicidal ideation and you're taking a medication, just know it's what happens is, if you're feeling suicidal and you're taking a medication that increases suicidal ideation, it's just going to amplify what was existing in your brain before, and you may try to do something to yourself, which was the case with me, because you're depressed, you feel like you don't want to go on anymore, and then you're taking a drug that, with the unintended consequence of making you want to hurt yourself, and then the next thing you know, you're attempting to hurt yourself. So it's a little scary, you know.
Right. Yes. Definitely. And that gets a little bit to the third part of that question about support systems.
Sure.
And what advice, like, do you have for somebody that is struggling, somebody that didn't, you know, necessarily check them into themselves into a hospital, who has not necessarily gotten to the stage where they're, you know, understand the different drugs and has that knowledge base. But at the same time, what about how do they start to take steps to develop a support system? What advice do you have for somebody to get that healthy support system going or in place, so that they do start, you know, taking the kind of steps maybe that you did and others?
If they don't have a therapist or close family members that they can lean on for help, you can always go to the emergency room and speak to the doctors or counselors that work at the hospitals. There are peer advocacy centers, or they're called crisis respite centers, and those are places where you know, if insurance covers it, you could stay for a few days and get some intense counseling and build a network that way. Whatever religion you follow, I encourage people to attend. You know, if you're Catholic or Christian, you go to church, or Jewish, you go to temple. I'm not someone that's particularly religious. I'm spiritual, but still, those places are good places for support. There's using Facebook for the positives. There are groups that are for mental health support, and But the quickest way is calling 911 and going to the hospital and speaking to either a psychiatrist or a social worker or a peer specialist, and they can get the ball rolling for you of what avenues are available where you can get help. And that's the most important part, is holding it in. Eventually it's going to ferment in some way. Either you're going to wind up doing drugs, you're going to drink, you're going to develop health problems. I used to train a woman when I was a personal trainer, and she was going through a bad divorce. Her husband was cheating on her, and she was just breaking out in rashes all over her body. She was developing styes in her eyes because of her immune system was so broken down from all the stress and anxiety that she was getting physically sick. And I also worked with I was training anorexic and bulimic teenage girls from a local hospital, because I was training their doctor, their psychiatrist. And she said, "Oh, I'm doing an outpatient program with some girls. Do you want to train them?" I said, "Well, what's going on?" She told me they're anorexic and bulimic. And she knew I had anxiety and depression. And I didn't understand why she wanted me to train them. And when I started training these girls and talking to them, not one of them had their eating disorders because of their body image. None of them thought that they needed to lose weight. They were all depressed and anxious and had anxiety about personal issues that were going on. Their families were getting, their parents were getting divorced, or someone had a drug problem, or they were traumatized by, you know, someone abused them. So, you know, the stereotype, oh, they think they're fat. You know, it was a big lesson I learned. And it was one reason why I went into teaching, was because I'm obviously a sensitive person, and being a phys ed teacher, it's probably the most social class that you can teach, because you don't have to be quiet during class while you're playing games. You're socializing with the children and you're learning about their lives. And so you start to learn why people act the way they do, and the causes of it goes back to it's not the question of what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. And once you learn that, what happened to you, and people get to share what's going on with themselves, and just someone to have a friendly ear, it's a big release for some people, you know, to get it off their chest and explain what's going on, or they express it in other ways. You know, artists, you know, people draw, people sing. So whatever way a person can express themselves is if it's done in a positive way, they can, you know, get through rough times, you know, so long as, you know, they're not hurting themselves.
Oh, definitely.
Right.
And I think you definitely hit on something important. I mean, as you get to know me, you'll discover I'm a passionate Kentuckian. I'm a Kentucky Colonel officially. And I actually got awarded that. But in our state, I mean, we have a horrible battle constantly through a lot of our counties with the opioid crisis. And underneath that is, I believe, mental illness is driving people to the opioids because of depression, the kind of, you know, subdued economic situations in a lot of the counties here and things like that.
Sure.
A lot of people, you know, they start going down some dark roads mentally,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, they go right into that drug culture. And so, I mean, yeah, what you're getting at is I think definite. I mean, they're going, yeah, it's going to express itself in a lot of unhealthy ways if you don't take a step and find that, initial help and that it's okay to get help. I mean, you're definitely hitting on a core thing, I think. Holly?
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Go ahead.
Holly? I think
did we
missed
I was responding to the chat room here.
Okay.
I was responding to Barbara.
Yeah, I just wanted to, because you've seen it too since you've been here with me. Yeah, as far as that side of it. Mm-hmm.
Also, the thing that, you know, for people that are listening, you know, these things, you know, finding a positive outlet and talking to people, it is difficult to do sometimes, and putting the work in to help yourself, it can be difficult. So, it sounds easy. Oh, just call for help. But, you know, people have reservations with their feelings, and sometimes it is tough to admit that there's something wrong or there's something going on. And that's the one thing that gets missed sometimes, where people say, yeah, well, I just, you know, took care of it. I went and, you know, I went to therapy and I know how to deal with it now. But people don't say, well, you know, doing the actual work that you put in, you know, it takes time and it doesn't happen overnight. And there's no promise that it's going to go away forever. And that when you do make progress, if you happen to have a bad week, it doesn't negate all the progress that you made, you know, because, you know, you've made so many strides and then you took a few strides back, but that doesn't negate everything that you accomplished in the meantime. So it's okay to feel, to be in a bad mood again, you know, for a little bit. And sometimes it's, I don't want to say healthy to be in a bad mood, but to when you're having bad feelings or you're feeling depressed and you're just trying to say, I don't want to feel like this anymore, and you try to fight it, it sort of makes it worse. And sometimes if you just let the emotions play out, or sort of like surfing a wave, you know, instead of fighting the wave, you know, you just go with it and surf it out, it could go away faster. So it's, some things sound easier said than done, but it's, you know, it can be difficult to make changes and to open yourself up to maybe thinking in a different way. But in the long run, it most certainly helps. And, having a realistic view of it. There's programs out there or people selling books or self-help things. And there's always this, oh, we guarantee you'll never have anxiety again, you know, or you're never going to be depressed again, or how you can beat anxiety. Well, you know, it's nice to think about, but it's unfortunately it's not very realistic, and you know, to sell somebody a false set of goods that that you're going to conquer this forever and you're never going to feel bad ever again in your life is taking away your humanity to a certain extent. You know, you're going to feel things, you know, you have a pet dog and the dog dies, you're going to feel sad, you know, and for some people that may last a few weeks and for some people that may last a few months. And, you know, it's okay to feel that way. And there's everybody, I feel everybody has a different timetable for things. And, and that's the other thing. Just because somebody completes something faster than you doesn't mean you can't do it, you know, at your own pace. And when people are really depressed and can't get out of bed, and it's like this force field that's holding you down, and they're just not doing anything. The people that have asked me what I do or what they should or what they I think they should do. When they're in that situation, I tell them, just take care of the basic things. Get out of your bed, brush your teeth, take a shower, go outside, take a walk, and start off slow. And I learned that from my own experience and from one of the nurses in the hospital. because I was talking about what I'm going to do when I get out. And she was like, slow down, Tiger. she was like, listen, if you can't just be discharged and then jump into life like it was before, or else you're going to end up back here. You're going to relapse quick. You need to get acclimated to life and get used to things again and, feel things out and rediscover yourself. So, it takes some work, but it's not something that's impossible to do. You just have to find what works for you. And the first thing is admitting to yourself and understanding that there is an issue there, and that you find your own way with the help of other people to get through it, and to have a realistic expectation of yourself that nobody is perfect. If you can believe that intrinsically, that hey, I'm not perfect, and this may take a while, and this is going to be tough. If you understand that, it makes it less tough. As long as you want to fight it, to a certain extent, but you can't completely fight it. You can't let yourself not experience emotions. You can't, for the younger people that don't know who Mr. Spock is, you can't go through life emotionless,
Right.
So it takes
time to process and to feel that. And we're all going to have pain, even those that may be mentally healthy, ups and downs, life's still going to smack them in the face. They're going to experience deaths around them. It's being human. That's part of the human emotional process. And you just have to learn to deal with that in a healthy way and find an outlet, like a creative outlet. What would you say are some of the outlets that you have, like art or music, or what are some of your outlets?
I grew up playing a lot of sports, so that eventually turned into really enjoying exercise. I also sing and play drums, so I've been a musician since I'm a little kid. So I'll sing, I'll play drums, I'll play some guitar, I'll draw. Going for a walk is, for me, going for a walk is probably the best thing that I could do for myself. Even if it's cold outside or the weather's not great, I'll still go for a walk. And the worst thing you could do for yourself is to lay around and be stuck in a funk. And it's like they say, the first step is the hardest. The first step getting out of that bed, it can feel like you're trying to bench press 1,000 pounds. It's such a powerful thing. Unfortunately, negative feelings are very, very strong, and they can hold you back more than positive feelings, depending on the chemical makeup of your brain. So finding some solace and some sort of a physical activity, which is, I don't know a lot about cognitive behavioral therapy, but I had a therapist that believed in it, and his philosophy was, get your body moving, do something, even if it's drawing, some sort of physical activity to change your mindset. Even if something as simple as turning on all the lights in your house, you're not sitting in the dark, or turning on some music just to change your stimulus around a little bit. And it tricks your brain into a different mindset and into concentrating on something else.
Yep.
I was in a one band, our keyboard player who had anxiety issues, he had a rubber band he would wear around his wrist. And anytime he started feeling that he was going to have a panic attack, he would just start snapping the rubber band on his wrist just to get his mind thinking about different things, And, you know, everybody's got their own little tricks, you know, and, you know, whatever works for you, you know, and makes you get out of that negative mindset is really important. And it's okay to, and I encourage people, you know, to do research online, you know, watch videos of therapists who have, you know, more experience and, you know, listen to podcasts and listen to other people, listening to other people's stories, is really helpful because it helps you realize you're not alone. And, the one thing that I always felt growing up that I never, because I was isolating myself and it wasn't, people didn't talk about, having depression and anxiety as much in the 80s as they do now, or is even in the 70s, was that does anybody else feel like I do? You know, who else feels this way? And, once you start, when I started doing group sessions in the hospital and talking to other people that were experiencing the same things or worse than I was, like they say, misery loves company. And you find yourself actually laughing. There's a lot of humor in the book too, because I have a bit of a dark sense of humor, so I make jokes about everything. But you find yourself, you know, laughing with somebody about you. I'm laughing about my suicide attempt and they're laughing about their suicide attempt, you know? And it's not that we thought it was funny. It's that we both came to this, this understanding where you hit the same nerve and you connect with that person. And there's a release that happens.
Yeah.
And you're able to laugh about it. It's almost like going to see. Yeah, it's almost like my favorite comedy bit of all is Eddie Murphy's Ice Cream Man. You know, when the ice cream man's coming and you're yelling at your mother, "Ma, send down some money." And who didn't do that as a kid? And you hear when he starts yelling, "Ma, send down some money," the audience goes crazy because he hit that nerve where everybody can relate to it. That's the other thing about the book while I was writing it, I was going through, well, okay, I'm writing about myself. I got tired of writing about myself. I want to write about the other people that I met and how things worked in the hospital. But I also wanted to convey, I wanted to describe the feelings of what I was going through the best I could, so that someone that is reading it could relate to it and go, "Oh my God, I felt that way too," you know, and, or they know somebody that goes through this. So this way they can see, oh, they're not the only person that goes through this because I read about it in so-and-so's book. There was a great book I read, another person's book I read, his name is Daniel Smith, and he wrote a book called Monkey Mind, a memoir on anxiety. And it was a fantastic book, and I read that about 12 years ago, and I learned, I was like, wow, he felt like I did, you know. And you know, taking from other people's experiences and my experiences, you want to make things give people something tangible to think about rather than it being a mystery. You know, and I describe in detail what my worst panic attacks were like, the throwing up and just being in just this physical pain. Every morning when I would wake up, I would have like the dry heaves. There was no food in my stomach. So it was like you drank too much and you're just heaving into the sink and there's nothing in your system except your diaphragm hurts and your back hurts from it. And you don't want to eat. You just feel there's a lump in your throat. You're sick to your stomach. And it hits you. You know, I felt like I was being possessed. I felt like the girl in The Exorcist. And you know, except my head wasn't spinning around. But, you know, other people go through that, and maybe they think they're the only ones that this happens to, and that they're some sort of anomaly. And when they realize, oh, it's not just me that feels this way, you know, there's some sort of solace that you can take in that. There's people, you know, that you read, the famous people, Bill Russell, who played for the Boston Celtics, who passed away recently, you know, 11 NBA championships. He used to throw up before every game because he was so nervous. And one of the famous stories from the coach, Red Auerbach, they were in a playoff game and they came out onto the court. And he said to Bill Russell, he goes, Russell, did you throw up before the game? And Bill Russell goes, no. And out of superstition, he goes, you get back in that locker room and you go vomit, and then you come back out. He wanted him to go throw up. So, and my hero, my musical hero, Eddie Van Halen, had terrible stage fright, which is why he smoked cigarettes and he drank. And, you know, I can name it like Barbara Streisand, who my parents were a fan of hers. She'd stage fright. That's why you never see her tour. And Carly Simon, people get terrible, you know, people that you don't think of that, you know, someone as brilliant as Eddie Van Halen had stage fright. How can he have stage fright? He was the best guitarist that ever lived, but you know, he was a very sensitive human being. And, everybody's human, you know.
Huge Van Halen fan here, by the way. Just so you know. Lifelong hard rock metal fan, and I love Van Halen since Fair Warning is when I first kind of picked up on him as a kid. I was about 10 when that came out.
That's my go-to album. I was 8 years old. Yeah, I was 8 years old when the first album came out, and I remember life before Van Halen. There was life before Van Halen and life after Van Halen. There's a chapter. since you like them so much, there's a chapter in the book that's dedicated toward music, and there's pages written specifically about Van Halen, and they just happened to be. Their music happened to be my saving grace when I was a teenager. I don't know I would have done. I don't know what I would have done without their music. I became a musician. I became a musician because of them. I delved in deeper into David Lee Roth more than what he was singing about. I would listen to his interviews and all his interests in life. He was an EMT. Actually, my ex-brother-in-law was his EMT instructor. You know, it's like, and my brother got to meet him. Like, everybody got to meet him. I never got to meet him. I haven't met him. I got my book to his apartment building.
Hopefully one day. He's out there.
But, you know, you attach yourself to something. And for me, it happened to be Van Halen. And I finally got to see. I saw them in 1984 at Madison Square Garden, and I was blown away. It saved me. Yeah. And it was then. I always knew I wanted to be a musician, but in combination of when we first got MTV, and you know the Oakland 81. Videos, right? You know, Unchained, hear about it later. And so This Is Love.
Yep.
So when we first got MTV, they didn't have much content. All they had was live concert footage from bands. So when I first saw the first thing I ever saw of them live was Unchained. And, you know, I forgot what video was on before, but I had just gotten home from sleepaway camp, and my brother goes, we got MTV. And I'm like, great. You know, you put it on, and then the screen went black. And you know how they had on the lower left-hand side of the screen where it says what band it is and what song it is. And the screen went black. The tag went up you know, for the video, and I went, oh my God, I'm going to see what they look like live. And it was profound beyond profound. And it really cemented the fact that music could bring me such primal joy. And, you know, I followed in that. I never became famous, obviously, but I was a busy musician from, I did my first gig in 1989 up until 2018, 2019. And, you know, played, I live in New York, so the tri-state area, you know, I've played definitely over 1,000 shows in my life. And, and music was really, I was really, when you read the chapter about music and the people I was involved with in college, and we had interest from Polygram Records and John Bon Jovi's cousin Tony Bon Jovi, and it was we weren't even close to getting signed, but they saw potential and wanted to see what else we could do. So it got to that point, and then Nirvana came out, and then we were done. As soon as the Seattle scene came about, we were done with, because we sounded like, you know, we were emulating Van Halen, we were emulating Bon Jovi and bands like that, and Motley Crue.
I would have loved you.
I wasn't going to wear spandex. I never wore spandex. You know, that wasn't my thing. You know, it was, I liked the way Joe Elliott dressed in, you know, back in the '80s, ripped jeans and a ripped t-shirt. And for me, that was good enough. But,
mullet of the '80s, probably the best mullet of the '80s.
Yeah. He definitely did. Him and John Cougar Mellencamp.
Oh yeah.
He had a good mullet. He had a good mullet going.
Oh yeah, great
but
stuff.
I really attached myself to music. I felt that I wanted to make it in music, not because I wanted to be famous. It was because it gave me peace of mind. I was doing something that I enjoyed, and it took my mind off of the anxiety and depression. So I found solace in that. And I said, if I get a record deal and I get to go on tour and I get to be in a successful band, then I'll be doing something that I love and something that keeps me going, has me something to live for. And, and going back to what David Lee Roth used to say in his interviews that were crazy, and he'd joke, but behind those jokes were, you know, find something in life that you love to do. He would say, it doesn't matter if you're a butcher or a baker or a donut maker, you know, find something that you love to, you know, find something that you love doing, and you'll be happy doing it. And,
never work a day in your life.
Yeah. You never work a day in your life. So, it's important, you know, going back to, you know, coping mechanisms to find what you love to do. And on the days that you don't want to do it, unfortunately you have to push yourself. And, you know, whether it's sometimes just a simple phone call to a good friend, can help you get out of bed, you know, when you're feeling a certain way. And, you know, there's so many different aspects to it. You know, interpersonal relationships, music that you love, artistic outlets. I found that punching a heavy bag, putting on the heaviest music, putting on the heaviest music I could find, in particular Seven Dust is a band that I like to work out to. Oh, they're great.
Love them.
Heavy music.
Oh, you're speaking my language. And
yeah,
I love hitting heavy bags too.
hitting a heavy bag, you know, listening to playlists of Seven Dust or Black Label Society, and getting out all those negative feelings. It really, you know, working yourself to some sort of physical exhaustion, sometimes is a good thing, you know, and having a good cry is I feel mm-hmm. very cathartic too. Some people don't like to cry, you know, I think it's healthy, that people do cry. Sometimes obviously they don't want to do it in front of other people, for obvious reasons, embarrassment or whatever. But when you're in a comfortable space, like a therapist's office, is the perfect place to do it. That's why there's a box of tissues next to the sofa, you know, or the chair that you're mm-hmm. sitting in. It's for that purpose. You know, it's so you can, it's a cleansing. And it's sort of like in the Green Mile, when the faith healer, you know, he opens his mouth and all those, like, it looks like bugs that are coming out of his mouth. And I'm like, oh, he's purging. You know, that's what crying is. You're purging your, mm-hmm. you're purging your brain of these pent up feelings that you had for so long.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is great. You and I have some serious common ground, and sure. I wanted to tell you too, Holly can vouch for this, but I went through the same, when you were speaking about the existential issues that you dealt mm-hmm. with, and you know, afterlife existence, you know, prior life, what comes next. I went through that same hurricane exactly, and
yeah.
Oh man, and I understand 100%, you know, what that kind of fear was like, and it sent me on a lifelong quest that's been amazing, but you know, in terms of that.
Mm-hmm.
What's that, Holly?
You have that aversion to death.
But I'm in a much better place for handling the issue of it, but I still have mm-hmm. aversion to it. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, yeah, I understood exactly what you're talking about. And, I cannot wait to read your book. And I think
Thanks.
It's amazing too, that you found the outlet, when you were in the psychiatric hospital, that you turned to writing, mm-hmm. in the form of the journals. And of course that, you know, I guess became kind of a foundation for the later book, you know, to evolve. But yeah, I think it's fascinating that, I see a lot of things, you know, cause I understand as a writer how you express through writing and I think it's great that you turn to that particular medium, you know, to start expressing while you were in it, in the middle of it. I mean,
I never thought I'd write a book. But what happened was one of the therapists, she was seeing me on a Friday. I was very drugged up. The thing that they do in the hospitals, you know, they tend to over-medicate you. And that was one of the big problems. That was one of the big problems I had there was, like, how many medications are you going to put me on? You know, this is ridiculous. I'm gaining weight. I don't feel like doing anything. The food's fattening, but I'm eating like an animal. And, I was at a point where I was just numb, you know, you're in your pajamas, you're numb, you don't feel like doing anything. And the therapist gave me one notebook and she goes, today's Friday. She goes, I'm going to see you on Monday. She said, write a paragraph for one paragraph for Friday, one paragraph for Saturday and one for Sunday. Three paragraphs. Do you think you could do that? And I said, yeah, I'll do that. And Monday rolled around and it was time for my appointment with her. So I went to her, the room, the office, you know, where we meet. And she was sitting at the table and I had the notebook with me and I tossed it on to the table and it slid right over to her. It landed right in her hands, you know, and I had this big smirk on my face. And she was smiling at me because she hadn't seen me smile in weeks. And she goes, did you write anything? And I said, yeah, 66 pages. And she said, oh my goodness, continue. So I continued and because she didn't overwhelm me with it. She didn't say, fill up this book. She said, just write three paragraphs. That's it. And each paragraph can be five lines each, six lines each. It was a no pressure, simple thing to do. And it was that simple message that opened up all this floodgate of creativity that I I mean, I always wrote lyrics, but I never kept journals. And I only wrote lyrics to songs when people had music. So I would never sit and write poetry just, you know, just for the fun of it. It would have to be for a reason. And I didn't know that this was inside of me. So it got to the point where I had been through so much and that I experienced serious things, very serious things. And then on the other hand, I experienced some really wacky and funny things because of being a musician. You get thrown into certain situations, and just having the sense of humor I have, I felt that there was a lot to put in there. And I'm like, well, that story's funny. And that story's funny. And well, you better talk about that. And so I wrote about just about every aspect of my life that you could think of, from, you know, my personal, obviously, you know, sex life and those sorts of things, to bathing habits, to everything. I was a big Howard Stern fan growing up, and I took, you know, you emulate, you know, people that influence you. And the thing about him that influenced me the most was his honesty. And what I loved about him the most was not when he was being shocking with guests or doing, you know, talking to strippers. It was when he would talk about his personal problems, his relationship with his parents, his toiletry habits, or, you know, or if he was gassy or just something,
right.
his own yeah. idiosyncrasies. And so yeah. I you know, I went that route of it. And, I also read a book when I was hospitalized about how to write a screenplay. And I said, how am I going to make this book make any sense? How is it going to flow? And so I read that book. So I guess it helped me gain some structure with it. And one of my favorite movies is Pulp Fiction. And one of the great things about the movie is that you can he goes from the past to the present to, you know, from storyline to different storyline, but it all flows and makes sense. And I wanted to have it flow sort of, you know, in that way. So while there, I go off on tangents in the book about my grandfather and my experiences with him, and he was in the Jewish mafia, and I tell that story. It all ties back in, you know, to the main subject matter of the book, you know, which is, you know, people have different stories to tell, and we're all basically the same. You know, someone was asking me about despair, and I was talking about how, you know, despair is a common feeling that all human beings get, but there's different roads that lead to it, you know. And there's a lot of advertisements on the radio that I hear in New York and on TV about PTSD for soldiers, you know. And while I've never been in the military, and thank God I've never been in a war zone, you know, they come back with despair, and it's still a common feeling that people get, you know, amongst each other, you know, that people share amongst each other. And even if you don't have the exact same experience as somebody else, the damage that it left and the feelings that you're left having are basically the same, you know. And and that's the sort of the message that that I try to, you know, share in the book.
Oh, the book just sounds amazing, and I think chat room is funny. Everybody is talking about getting the book, so yeah, I got a lot of new readers hopefully out of this. And sure. Yeah, we could. I just know we've talked for hours. I mean, I already can see that we have tons of areas of common ground, just myself with you. And we don't want to overrun our welcome because we did go a few more extra minutes because we wanted to get all of this because this has just been fantastic. So,
I appreciate you having me.
But yeah, well, I do want to let you tell folks. First of all, where to get the book, and then if there are any social media platforms or anything or websites, anything of that nature for folks to connect with you if you have those available.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the name of the book is The Psych Ward Notes, Surviving Anxiety and Depression. If you Google it, it'll show up on Amazon. It's on Amazon, Kindle, Audible. It's on 42 audiobook apps. So if you don't, audiobooks.com, Chirp. So if you don't feel like reading it, you can listen to it. I'm on Facebook under Peter Vox, V-O-X. I'm on Twitter under the same name. I'm on LinkedIn, how I found you guys. People can leave me messages if they have any questions. I'm happy to answer anybody's questions that they have. And, just Google the name, the Psych Ward Notes. So it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart. There's some independent stores in Europe, independent book chains in Europe that carry it as well. And, it's pretty available. So easy to find.
Yeah.
I do have another question though.
Sure.
Have you thought about writing a follow-up book? Have you thought about writing one now?
Yeah.
About how you have overcome, things you've done to, find your outlets, your support group, tips you can give people well on the other side since you now can reflect that.
I haven't. I started putting together an outline for a second book, and it's about my experience teaching in the New York City school system, which is in part of, I touch on it in the book about what it was like and why I retired early. That's a whole other book in itself.
I can imagine.
Right.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I have enough for a second book, but what I'm more interested in, I just completed the first round of training to become a peer specialist, and so I'm getting my New York State license for that. So I'm more interested in doing symposiums or guest speaking or talking to people one-on-one or sitting with groups, small groups of people or doing more podcasts just to elaborate more about what I'm doing these days and the things that I'm learning more about myself. What I keep learning in my own therapy from my own therapist, because I talk to a therapist twice a week, and I think it's important for people to go. It's tough these days to find a good therapist to connect with. I don't want to say anything bad about psychiatrists, but they don't do talk therapy like they used to. Now with a psychiatrist they check in with you once a month, they make sure you're taking your meds and you say, yeah. And then you say, do you want to kill yourself? And you go, no. And they go, okay, it was good talking to you. And they sort of, cut you off pretty quick. So, the therapy now is really with psychologists and social workers and peer specialists and other, and friends that have been through, the same things that you have or somebody that can, that understands, what you're going through. And there's still things that I don't understand and I'm always learning. I don't know everything about therapy and psychology, which was part of the, I think part of the attraction toward the book, because I'm not a doctor. I'm not talking from a clinical standpoint. I'm talking about, well,
right,
these are my feelings.
They don't even know it all.
Yeah, you know, these are my feelings and these are my theories about it, and this is why I think a person acts like this, or this is why I think, you know, this behavior occurs in people. And luckily, my own therapist has been recommending the book to his other patients. So, well, there goes our patient, our doctor patient confidentiality, you know. But he goes, well, you wrote a whole book about your whole life, you know. And I said, well, yeah, you can tell him it's, you know, I'm one of your patients, you know. I really don't care, you know, because I, you know, you write about everything. But I didn't want it to be that, you know, I'm a doctor and I'm educated and here's my PhD and it's right on the front. And it's, you know, I'm a real person that's lived it or living it, you know.
Yeah, it's your journey.
It's an ongoing thing. Sometimes I wish I changed the title instead of Surviving Anxiety and Depression, because it sounds like I'm over it, or to living with anxiety and depression, because it is something you live with.
You always can go back. You can put a new cover. You can change the title and a new release. You can always do that. So.
Yeah, that's true. When the contract runs out with the publisher.
Okay.
So who knows?
Yeah, as,
who knows?
As candid as you are, I hope you do. As candid
as you are,
I mean, I hope you do continue and maybe look at doing a follow up some point.
Maybe.
I will be sending you some information, because we'd love to have you join us next July. We put on a conference, a convention, every year. It's all around creative writing, all genres, including nonfiction. We have speakers. We have over 130 panels and workshops, presentations, an international film festival.
That's great.
Covers like everything around writing.
But our community, mental illness is big. But it's big. Mental illness is a big issue right now with the creative community.
I always have a lot of programming, a lot of, you know, we have workshops and panels that cover creatives and mental illness around that spectrum.
Yeah.
So we always do, and they're always heavily attended by our attendees. So
definitely. I'll make a trip. It's in Kentucky.
Yep.
Yes.
Bluegrass.
Yes, in Louisville, Kentucky.
You got it.
I'll be there. I'll be there definitely.
Yeah, I have just enjoyed this, and I can't wait to talk music with you too, because you and I share the same stuff.
Gotta talk some Van Halen.
Oh, you got it, man.
Yeah.
And that'd be fantastic. And,
thank you so much for spending
the time with us. And I'll let Holly wrap it up with you. But, yeah, I just want to thank you for, just being so candid, open about, you know, an issue as sensitive as this, and distilling it into a way that people like us and our audience can relate to. You're right. You approach it in a understandable way that connects, you know, not a heavy academic kind of style. I mean, it's something I think I think you've got a gift for this. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the kind words. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And Holly, you want to wrap her up with Peter?
Yeah, I will be in touch. Tomorrow.
Okay.
I will send you a plethora of information, but yeah, love to have you come out. And thank you for joining us. This has been one of our best shows ever. It's been informative. It's going to help people. I know a lot of creatives can relate, because their outlets have been art, writing, music, you know, doing poetry, you know, all these different aspects of the whole art spectrum. We pour ourselves into our creations, right? You know, for release. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I I definitely know it's going to touch a lot of people, and it will be available for playback in about 15 minutes after the show, so feel free to share it. We will continue to share the links so people can
stream and download.
Listen to
great, thank you.
Stream
the
download. But yes, thank you for being a guest, and like I said, I will be in touch tomorrow on LinkedIn. I'll hit you up. And everybody, tune in next week, Wednesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for another enthralling episode of the Star Chamber Show. And I hope you have a wonderful week, and create, create, create. Good night, all.
Night, everyone.
Good night.